Good morning. May it please the court. Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant Dewan Dixon. Mr. Dixon was convicted based in large part on a out-of-court testimonial statement of a witness whom he was never permitted to cross-examine. Without the statement, there was no clear and direct evidence linking Mr. Dixon to the crimes for which he was charged. Not only did the introduction of the statement violate the rules of evidence, it also violated Mr. Dixon's confrontational rights, and his convictions must be reversed. At trial, the state sought to introduce a 911 call wherein the caller identified whom she believed to be the shooter, which was Mr. Dixon. Mr. Dixon's attorney objected, saying that it was inadmissible hearsay. The court listened to the tape, and the state argued that it was an excited utterance. The court did listen to the tape and found that the caller sounded excited. She describes herself as being upset. She was out of breath and moving. But the court also noted that she was obviously angry, and there could be a legitimate argument that this was more than a spontaneous declaration. The court then relied on Davis versus Washington, which is not a hearsay case. It is a confrontation case, and concluded that this is excited utterance and therefore was permissible. The court did not address the confrontation issue in Davis.
To what extent is that a finding of fact to which we should defer?
With respect to his finding that the caller was out of breath,
right.
I believe the court must accept that as a finding of fact, what he found, but the entirety of his finding. And his other portion of his finding is that she was angry, but it's not dispositive of whether this is an excited utterance. Whether it is an excited utterance is based on whether the individual had an opportunity for reflective thought, not whether the person was simply upset or that there was a short time period. Those are factors. But the proponent of the evidence must show that there was not an opportunity for reflective thought. And that's because the exceptions to the hearsay rule are exceptions because there's circumstances that provide an indicia of trustworthiness. And the comments by the caller in this case reveal that she did have an opportunity for reflective thought. Her entire tape of her statement, and that's the transcripts at A7 through 12.
Does that happen with every 911 call?
No, Your Honor, it does not. The distinction can be seen in Davis provides a great distinction. There are actually two cases combined. One is Hammond, one is Davis. So I'll just call them the first and second calls. The first call was made by a woman who was on the phone saying, "Oh, my God," I'm paraphrasing, but "I'm being beaten by my husband. He's coming to get me. I'm scared to death." The court said that is non-testimonial. It found that it was an excited utterance. That's correct. and then also found that the other statement, which was one that was made at the scene in response to questioning, could also be considered an excited utterance. However, it was considered testimonial. And what other courts have concluded is that when in situations like this where they provide a narrative, there are two problems. One, it could be an excited utterance. The other, it could be testimonial.
Well, is the issue here which of these categories the 911 call in this case falls into?
It is a testimonial statement because it was made after.
Well, is the issue question. That we have to decide whether it is or isn't testimonial?
The issue is that the court needs to decide that it is testimonial, yes.
That's what you'd like us to say.
Yes, whether or not it's testimonial or not testimonial.
As I understand the facts of this case, according to the caller, shots were fired almost moments before the call, and the person was running away from the area of the gunfire, and the caller wanted someone to apprehend the perpetrator.
That's correct.
And during the entire call, that's what was going on. It wasn't like the police arrived and she continued talking to them or anything like that. Is that correct?
That's correct. But if the court were to listen to the CD and also look at the transcript, we'll find that the significant portion of her call from the very beginning when the 911 caller got, dispatcher got a hold of her, the first thing out of her mouth was, here's what you need to do. You need to go to 24th and Carter Street. She's telling them what is necessary for purposes of investigation and how they should run their investigation.
Well, let me just ask you a more general question. You know, you're arguing that this is, as a matter of law, was a testimonial statement, and therefore there was reversible error. I imagine the other side is arguing that as a matter of law, it was an excited utterance. What if it has elements of both? That is, it's in a gray area. What is there any case law that guides us as to how we review that type of statement?
Yes, Your Honor. There are cases in other jurisdictions have concluded that even if the statement is an excited utterance, it can be considered testimonial and not admissible. Is that your question?
Well, I'm not sure how I'm not sure that that really responds to our problem, which is that what we really may have here is a gray area type of out-of-court statement that has elements of both.
Right.
You know, is that a factual finding that we review only for, you know, the absence of substantial evidence? Is it a mixed question of fact and law? What is it?
Well, we're here on a legal decision. The facts that the judge found that she was out of breath at certain points, that she was upset, cannot be disputed here on appeal. What is being disputed is, does the contents of this statement amount to an excited utterance, and whether or not it did it amount to a testimonial statement wherein his confrontational rights were violated?
Well, tell us why you think it doesn't qualify as an excited utterance. And as I indicated, you have the person calling shortly after the gunfire. She's very upset. She wants the police to come and apprehend the shooter, and she's concerned about safety in the neighborhood. And that's the only concern she has throughout the conversation. There are a couple of interruptions where they try to get her name, and she says, I'm not giving you my name because I'm not testifying. But she keeps coming back to the theme that someone should get here right away because the shooter is still here, and she wants the person apprehended for purposes of safety. Now, that's in the record. Tell us where it wasn't an excited utterance from the beginning, or where it stopped being an excited utterance somewhere along the line.
Your Honor, when we're looking at an excited utterance, the question is whether the individual had an opportunity to reflect on the situation. That takes away the trustworthiness. The entire content of her conversation, she offered opinions as to the way law enforcement reacts to neighborhoods. She offered opinions as to the client and his religious beliefs. She offered opinions as to how the state should proceed in its investigation.
It was not an excited utterance from the very beginning?
That's correct. It was not. The very first thing out of her mouth was, here's what you need to do. You need to come down here. She's telling them how to run their investigation. She's not, oh, my God, I'm in peril. This guy's chasing everybody. She did say she was running from him. The other wrinkle for the state here is whether this event caused the excitement. She states in her statement.
So is your position it's more on the content of the statement as opposed to a temporal element? I mean, do you agree that there can be an excited utterance within 10 minutes of an event?
I think, yes, it depends on the circumstances. And I think this court has recognized that. In cases such as Culp versus State, the court noted that the woman was crying and hysterical and found an excited utterance, but it also noted that the call was being made at the time the incident was happening. So the time of it and the emotional state of the caller are significant, but they are only circumstances. That's not the end of the discussion. The question is, did she have an opportunity to engage in reflective thought? And she did here. The other point is, the excitement that precedes her call must be what the call is about here. And while arguably it was the shooting here, she states to the caller, I'm very upset. I'm outside this time of night because my sister just got beat up. And then she goes on to say, but at the same time, I can stand here and be talking, indicating she was deliberately taking time to call 911 even though she was upset, and there's another reason that she possibly could be upset because of. And the state recognized the deliberateness of the statement by the caller in its closing when it said that she made it a point to say twice who the shooter was.
Is it your position that there is no part of the 911 call that's admissible as an excited utterance?
That's correct, because it could be in certain circumstances if the first thing out of her mouth, such as in Davis, this is we're going into the testimonial part of the argument, and even if the court were to find this as an excited utterance, then it's still testimonial and should be excluded. And in Davis versus State, the beginning of the call was, my husband's beating me up, I'm scared, etc. But after, and the court said that's non-testimonial. But after the man left the house, the court said the remainder could therefore be testimonial. And so that part wasn't discussed. So to answer your question, portions of the call could, in reality, be admissible, but that's not the case here. Because from the beginning...
You're not arguing then, I mean, I just want to make sure I didn't misunderstand you. You're not arguing that even if we were to uphold the ruling that this was an excited utterance, that it could nonetheless be testimonial?
Yes, I am.
You are arguing that?
Yes.
Okay. How? That is, how does that work? Okay. How does that rule operate?
Under Davis versus Washington, that was exactly what the court addressed two excited utterances, found one to be testimonial and one to be non-testimonial. And what the difference is, if an excited utterance is made for purposes of invoking prosecutorial intervention to apprehend somebody, to invoke the judicial process, knowing that the statement may be used later for trial, which she knew here, she said, I'm not testifying, and versus a call made because they're in peril. Both of those situations in Davis were excited utterances. One was testimonial, one was not testimonial. And that's, if the court were to conclude this was an excited utterance, that's exactly the situation we have here. And the trial court...
Well, is the focus on the purpose of the declarant or the purpose of the police in asking the question?
The focus is on what a reasonable witness would believe the objective purpose of the call is, and that's what Davis says.
Well, doesn't Davis say the primary purpose... Statements are non-testimonial when made in the course of police interrogation under circumstances objectively indicating that the primary purpose of the interrogation is to enable police assistance to meet an ongoing emergency.
Yes, Your Honor, but Davis versus Washington also says that 911 calls can qualify, and that if the purpose of the interrogation, which a 911 call could qualify, is to establish or prove past events potentially relevant to later criminal prosecution, then that is testimonial. And that's what we have in this case. We have a situation where she made a 911 call to report something. In fact, in one part she says, he's going to get it now, indicating that the purpose of her call was to start an investigation, get the guy off the street, not because she was personally in an ongoing emergency, which is what Davis makes a distinction about.
Ms. Walker, the lights aren't working the way they normally work.
Okay.
So you have about 2.5 minutes of your total time left. We used up some of your rebuttal.
Yes, that's fine. I'll reserve the rest. Thank you.
Very well.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. James Wakely on behalf of the State of Delaware. Your Honor, in this case, Mr. Dixon waived his Confrontation Clause objection by making solely an objection on the basis of hearsay. This Court found relatively recently in Nally v. State that by making the objection solely on the grounds of the evidentiary rules, that does not preserve the evidentiary basis. Even if this court were to review the Confrontation Clause objection, the statement was non-testimonial. As Your Honor put it, this is moments after the shooting. She's clearly trying to get the police there to stop what is going on. She is running away. That is a finding of fact subject to the clearly erroneous standard from below. She is out of breath. That is readily apparent from listening to the tape. Just because it may not come through on the transcript, the entire tape is 2 minutes and 40 seconds long. And though I may be dating myself, if you recall the Micro Machines commercials, that's what she sounds like.
Well, Mr. Wakely, my problem is that, you know, both sides seem to be making factual arguments. The facts have been determined by the trial court. So if, you know, if we're to either uphold or overturn those factual, that is, the ruling based on those factual findings, it has to be made on the basis of some principled argument. And if your argument is that we should affirm because, as a matter of law, this is clearly an excited utterance, what can you articulate the principle that would guide us in getting to that result?
Certainly, Your Honor. This court in Warren and Culp very clearly elucidated the standard for an excited utterance. It was the excitement of the declarant was precipitated by an event. I don't think there can be any serious question that the excitement of this woman was precipitated by watching Dewan Dixon shoot into a group of people. The statement being offered was made during the time period while the excitement of the event was continuing. Once again, Your Honors, I would urge you to listen to the tape. She is extremely agitated. She's out of breath. She says she's running from him. Yes, she's angry, but she's just seen someone fire a gun in her neighborhood into a group of people. And the statement was related to the startling event. Once again, I don't think there can be any serious question that this was related to the shooting. The opportunity for reflective thought standard that Ms. Walker would have you adopt has never been adopted here. The standard was from Culp, and it was the analysis must focus on the condition of the declarant at the time the statement was made. In Culp, the shooting was over. The call was made by a neighbor. Ms. Culp was extremely agitated. She had just shot someone. The person was, yes, injured at that point, but up to an hour later, the woman was still agitated, extremely so. And here, this is nowhere near an hour, and she is still very much agitated. There is no even if this court were to adopt the opportunity for reflective thought theory, there was no opportunity for reflective thought. She's running away. She's panting. She's out of breath. Those are findings of fact, and this is mere moments after the shooting.
Well, let's assume you're right on the excited utterance and that we may only get to Davis in the Davis argument on plain error. What's your view on the application of Davis to this call?
Your Honor, this is very clearly the first of the two Davis scenarios. This is a 911 call. Hammond dealt with the companion case, primarily dealt with statements that were made in an affidavit that was signed at the scene while police were present. That was analogized to the Crawford, they were in custody in the police station scenario. This is clearly a 911 call, and Davis set out the factors for evaluating just such a call, and it was the primary purpose test. What was the primary purpose of the communication? From the declarant's point of view, there are factors that are external to the declarant, but the thrust of it is, what was the declarant's purpose in making the statement? And that's readily apparent here. It was to get police to respond to that location as soon as they possibly could. The other thrust of that was the level of formality of the police interrogation.
By the way, you and Ms. Walker seem to agree, at least on that point, that the purpose of the call was to get the police onto the scene. But Ms. Walker goes on and says, yes, but... that was only to start the law enforcement process, the investigation process, and therefore it was really there was some calculation behind it. It wasn't just pure spontaneity.
I would suggest, Your Honor, that's not a fair characterization of what happened here. If she were really trying to assist with later prosecution, she would have given Mr. Dixon's last name. She clearly knew it based on her statements on the tape. She knew his first name was DeJuan. When she was asked, oh, no, no, I'm not giving you that. She didn't give her name.
Wouldn't a statement be admissible under Davis if, in, as a matter of fact, the 911 caller has a secondary purpose to prove past events potentially relevant to later criminal prosecution?
Well, I would suggest, Your Honor, that that's a circumstance that would be very common. Obviously, when somebody is calling for police assistance, their first instinct is to get police assistance. But that doesn't necessarily preclude them from saying, I also want to see the person prosecuted for what they've done. I mean, clearly this woman is angry, but her intent and her emotion are driven by a desire to get police there to stop this person.
What was the state's other evidence in this case?
Your Honor, there were two other pieces of evidence. There was Mr. Butcher's hospital identification from a six-photo lineup. After less than 10 seconds, he identified Mr. Dixon, though he later changed his story when he got to trial. And also, when Mr. Dixon was arrested, he had the gun on his person. The gun was positively matched to three shells that were taken from the scene. The bullet... No rounds were recovered. The bullet itself remains lodged in Mr. Butcher's leg, but the shell casings recovered from precisely where Mr. Butcher told the police officer they would be were an absolute match.
And what for what purpose did the state use the 911 call, you know, substantively?
There were two purposes, one that ended up being for naught. First, obviously, is to support the case that he was indeed the shooter. There was also a charge of reckless endangerment with Ms. Hackett, the maker of the call, as the victim. That charge was dismissed at on a motion for judgment of acquittal, in part for lack of an evidentiary basis. Specifically, we didn't know where she was in relation to the shot. That was a large part of the trial court's decision in dismissing that charge.
All right. So tell me again why the call was used.
The call was used first to identify Mr. Dixon as the shooter.
All right. So then if we go back to the other evidence that you've identified, we have the victim of the shooter picking him out of a photo lineup and subsequently recanting his testimony, his identification.
Not entirely recanting. Just said he didn't see the shooter, but he did testify that he saw Mr. Dixon there approximately 5 to 6 minutes before the shooting.
And he admitted picking him out of a photo lineup.
Yes, sir.
And then the second is the evidence that Dixon actually had the gun in his possession when he was arrested.
Yes, sir.
So in the scheme of things, where does the 911 call fit in as in the strength of the state's case?
As to the charges of which Mr. Dixon was actually convicted of, the state was just there. That's the third best evidence that we had behind the eyewitness identification and behind him actually possessing the gun. It was certainly not absolutely necessary to convict him. Obviously, it was necessary at trial given the state's intent to prosecute for reckless endangerment in the first degree towards Ms. Hackett. But
this was the only identification evidence that wasn't recanted.
Yes, but at the time, Your Honor, we were not aware whether Mr. Butcher would recant or not. It was many months later. I think there was an idea that he may, and the state was prepared to perform the 3507 examination, which they actually did perform here.
Tell me how that fits into the photo lineup. We have a lineup where he identifies him, but did he ever make a separate 3507 statement that Dixon was the shooter?
No.
So what are you characterizing as the 3507 statement? The photo ID?
The photo ID, Your Honor. Okay. And the fact that he identified it within approximately 10 seconds was the police officer's estimation of the amount of time. Just to be absolutely clear, though that statement was given in the hospital, according to Mr. Butcher, he was not under any medication at the time that he made that statement. That statement was mere hours after the shooting. And there was no indication that it was in any way unreliable for some circumstance other than his later recantation. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you.
I just want to clarify the testimonial argument and then address the harmless error if I can. First of all, the issue should not be considered waived on appeal, as the court specifically relied on Davis versus Washington, which is a Confrontation Clause case. And in McCandless versus, the Third Circuit concluded, McCandless versus Vaughn, that as long as there are federal cases employing constitutional analysis that are relied upon, the court should consider the argument preserved. The testimonial argument is this: accepting all the facts that the court found, not asking this court to reject those facts, and let's assume this court decides that amounts to excited utterance. That excited utterance is testimonial. And Davis versus State clearly says excited utterances can be testimonial. And that's what the situation is here. And the reason it's testimonial is that the purpose of the call was to prove past events potentially relevant to later prosecution. She did not make the call because she was in the danger of immediate peril. Now, she may have been running, but she clearly listened to the CD, and clearly the judge is right in his findings. But I think it clearly establishes that the purpose was not to be relieved from ongoing peril.
Well, let's assume two purposes. Let's assume that she has the purpose of narrating past events, as you indicated. But the police have a purpose of responding to what seems to be an ongoing emergency. So that's the purpose of their interrogation. Which one governs? Under Davis.
Under Davis, it would be the purpose of the call, her purpose of the call. And, Your Honor, from the very beginning, without any questioning, she went right into saying, go to this place, get here before the powder gets off his hands. Not get here because I'm in peril.
Why didn't the Supreme Court use primary purpose of the call as opposed to primary purpose of the interrogation?
Your Honor, it may not have used those words, but the words that it did use was what a reasonable witness, objective witness, would reasonably believe that the statement would be available for use at a later trial. And I think the content here clearly shows that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. The court will take the matter under advisement and will also take a brief recess.